Okay, we will start with a question for Professor Winkelmeier. So, to what extent do you believe is the divergence that we see between the patient top priorities and the study topics that we see out there being actually pursued, to what extent is that being driven by industry? Meaning, for example, industry wants to sell phosphate binders, and hence you're going to see phosphate binder studies.
Industry does what industry is designed to do. Under the ramifications in which they operate. Clearly, the surrogate outcomes indicate large areas of medical need. Otherwise, industry would not have picked them out. Industry can bring drugs and devices to market based on surrogate outcomes, and hence, as industry usually tends to be risk-averse, they will do that and nothing else. So I think it's not something that is particularly driven by industry or where anybody should blame industry, but rather they are doing what they're supposed to do given the current regulatory environment. And I think that's why it's important for us to bring in the patient voice and to tie in the regulatory process and the regulatory stakeholders so that a framework can establish that really satisfies most people around the table. That's my personal opinion.
Thank you. Question for Dr. Kistler. Given your insights and also the discussion that we've heard yesterday, where do you fall on that spectrum of patients should absolutely not eat during dialysis versus it's absolutely okay and patients should eat during dialysis?
That's a loaded question. I fall in the middle. And so I think that we need to pay more attention to who is eating. Some of the data I showed you, we actually did a full cardiovascular workup on the patients before we fed them, and we found very similar to Dr. Zakali that patients with autonomic dysfunction are more likely to have a drop in postprandial blood pressure. And so I think what I would like to see is that we work towards some recommendations, because what I do see is that a lot of clinics have a lot of different policies. So we published a paper in CJSN just this year looking at clinic policies in all of DaVita's clinics. And if you look at those policies in detail, there's about 1,000 different policies. It's very much a wild west, and I think you see some of that ambiguity sneaking over to dietitians in that they're afraid to talk to patients about their intradialytic food choices. And so I'd really like to see us work towards recommendations.
Thank you. Dr. Kasten, would you recommend taking all end-stage renal disease patients off of statins?
I don't like to make a universal recommendation. I mean, if you look at the median LDL cholesterol in the dialysis patient population, it's approximately 60. If you look at the controlled trials, the LDLs were 100. So we're looking at a population probably between 125 and down. Personally, I think there's no experimental evidence to suggest that statins are useful. But if a practicing physician has a patient with a LDL cholesterol of 180 or 200, I don't think we have the data to tell that physician not to prescribe the drug under that circumstance. I think that's really a care issue rather than something which we have scientific evidence to support.
Thank you. Professor Winkelmeier.
George, I completely agree with that statement. And one thing that we really need to consider as practicing nephrologists, especially in the unit, you know, we know that our patients have a huge medication load. You know, they take a median of 11 different medications, a median of, like, I think 30-ish or something drugs. And patient, you know, nobody in their real mindset can assume that every patient indeed takes every single pill that we think they should be taking. Patients make choices among these different therapies, and they may make choices that are misguided. I think for us it's an opportunity and a responsibility to help them weed it out in a way that hopefully maximizes focus on therapies that have evidence supporting their use and discontinue those that are not supported.
Let's take one question from the audience, please.
Hi, thank you. This is on hypertension treatment. We take care of patients who are much older, in the 70s to 90 range. They develop systolic hypertension, a wide pulse pressure, and the newest study that came out, which showed lower the blood pressure, the better it is, and they terminated the study because of increased cardiovascular mortality. But that doesn't jive with the patients we treat. They get very symptomatic when you drop the systolic blood pressure to even 140 sometimes. What are your thoughts, and are they, should we have a separate range, age range for different blood pressure guidelines? Because it's very hard to get a blood pressure 120 over 80 on a 90-year-old and say, you're doing fine.
Yeah. I completely agree with that point and acknowledge that a similar clinical experience. I think, and this kind of answers one of the questions I have in front of me, is the role of arterial stiffness that occurs, especially as patients age. It makes it very difficult to lower these patients, and they often become very symptomatic to increasing levels of blood pressure medications and lower blood pressures. I think there's good data to suggest that sometimes we counter with mental clarity and mental status in these patients that too low is bad, but there's emerging data that higher blood pressure in these extremely elderly patients leads to more subclinical strokes and stuff. So I think it's still reasonable to treat blood pressure, keep them definitely out of levels, that 180s, 170s I think are too high. But aiming for really what the European guidelines argue, which is blood pressure, a systolic blood pressure below 160. I think it's also important to acknowledge that diastolic blood pressure and too low a diastolic blood pressure in these patients is dangerous. A lot of data supports that once you start getting diastolic blood pressures below 70, that can be harmful irrespective of what the systolic blood pressure. So a systolic of 160 and doing that without jeopardizing extremely low diastolic pressures is the way I kind of approach these patients. And I say specifically for patients over the age of 80, but some in the late 70s as well I would include in that category.
Dr. Kaysen, would you like to take one more question?
Of these?
Yep.
One question was, is there relationship between cardiovascular mortality and lipids been adjusted for albumin levels? They've been adjusted for nutritional or inflammatory variables. We've actually done longitudinal studies looking at ApoB and ApoA1. ApoB actually doesn't vary during inflammation, so inflammation doesn't seem to play a role in changing LDL levels. It does play a role in lowering HDL levels, but I think that the relationship between lipoproteins and outcomes is already adjusted for inflammation.
As a matter of fact, while we're on the topic of inflammation, I have a question here that I'd like to give everybody on the panel the opportunity to chime in if they want to. And the question is, what are your top recommendations? What are your top recommendations to lower COP levels in CKD and end-stage renal disease patients? What are the things you would focus on for COP lowering?
One should get the fistula out, get a fistula in. I think that tunnel dialysis catheters are clearly playing a role. I look for sources of inflammation, periodontal disease. Another area that we can approach, which has been looked at actually at RRI, is making the water as clean as possible. And there have been several prospective studies showing that ultrafiltering the dialysis water, reducing the lipopolysaccharide that's present in circulating dialysis fluids, will reduce IL-6 and CRP. So those are things that we can do that are clearly safe. In regard to anti-cytokine therapy, we have to wait for something. I mean, we participated in a trial of etanercept and had no effect on CRP. You're working with potentially life-threatening drugs. We have to make certain that, if we're looking at a pharmacokinetic way of going after it, that we have to be cautious.
Mm-hmm. Would the other colleagues want to add anything to that discussion?
I'll add that I think diet is an underappreciated thing as well. I was just recently at a talk that it was a cardiovascular grand rounds we had at Yale, and it was promoting strictly plant-based diets and the role of non-plant-based foods and their role for cardiovascular disease and inflammation. And some of the studies is pretty dramatic that in these patients on a strict plant-based vegan diet, they had dramatic improvements in their cardiovascular disease that far outweighed what lipids, what statins can do in other drugs. And I'm not sure that it's something that you can apply to all patients, but I think at least eating a healthy diet goes a long ways in terms of tampering down inflammation in the body, and that mainly, to me, means lean meats, less sugars, and high fruits and vegetables that have antioxidants in them.
Thank you. I think Dr. Turner, we had two more questions for you as well.
Okay, so one question was, what do you believe are the most important issues proven to delay CKD progression? I think when we talk with our patients, we probably overstate the things that actually do delay progression of CKD, and I don't think that's wrong. I think it's important to talk about glucose lowering and things like that. I think the things that are most proven is blood pressure lowering. I talked about that I didn't think the data was effective at blood pressures below 140 over 90, but I think when you look at blood pressures above that, I think there's good data to support that achieving a blood pressure of 140 over 90 versus higher is effective at slowing CKD progression irrespective of what the cause of CKD is. And I also think you can't underestimate the role of the RAS inhibitors, particularly in diabetes and proteinuric kidney disease. They've been well shown to slow progression even moderately, even when the disease is moderately progressed. Glucose lowering isn't clearly effective once you're out of the gates. I think the data isn't very robust in terms of slowing progression, but we should still continue to tell our patients to do it. We heard earlier that lipids haven't shown to slow renal progression, but have good benefit for cardiovascular disease. I think, though, something that might be underestimated might be smoking cessation. I think that goes a long ways, probably for inflammatory reasons and whatnot as well.
Thank you. Dr. Kaysen, was there one other question on your plate?
Yeah, you. The question is, should we change our recommendation for lipid-lowering therapy for patients with CKD and patients who are on dialysis? Certainly, I would treat a patient with CKD the same as I would a patient without renal failure with regard to treatment guidelines. We have no data to discriminate within levels of CKD. They certainly are at risk of cardiovascular disease. So statins are exceptionally safe medications. So I would certainly treat them as I would someone without renal failure. But once they've entered dialysis, there's actually little support for treating lipid disorders in the population. It doesn't appear to do much for outcomes.
And if I counted correctly, for Dr. Turner, we have one more question, correct?
Yeah, so this is a good question. So I'll read it to you. It's, do you recommend loop diuretics for hypertension management only in CKD patients with clinical evidence of volume overload, or more broadly in those with the eGFR less than 30, even with no or subacute volume overload? I think ACE inhibitors, ARBs, and diuretics are all important agents in CKD. I do think, barring cardiovascular disease in diabetics, I think the diuretics themselves are probably the most important, even in patients with without overt volume overload. The GFR is in constant decline, and if the patient isn't clearly volume overloaded, when you're seeing them, it's possible that they will before they come back to see you in clinic again as their GFR declines. And in addition, we know, extrapolating from the general population, that using diuretics, particularly thiazide diuretics, as first-line therapy in some of the cardiovascular outcomes trials seem to be as effective as ACE inhibitors, such as the ALLHAT study. So, and that was irrespective of patients that were clinically volume overloaded. So I think they're an important drug that should be commonly used unless there's strong reasons to go with an ACE inhibitor first, which would mainly be cardiovascular disease or diabetes.
Thank you. And I just wanted to comment on what we've just seen about the SONG initiative. You know, I think it's so important to see how the research that we're doing is actually aligned with those priorities as they are ranked by the various stakeholders. And I took particular note also of the vascular access complications being, you know, making it to that final list there, and being top rated for healthcare professionals. Did you expect to see what you now know that you've seen, or what surprised you most?
Well, I think we all tried to go into this process as agnostic as possible. That's at least a good scientific way. But vascular access certainly was not a surprise that it rose up, and it's a big priority for a number of research groups around the world now, as well as for the NIDDK that have really had made, you know, vascular access a research and intervention priority. You know, clearly it's something that's high on our minds as providers. It's, you know, as common and as present for us as it is for the patients that thought that they would have an evening in front of the TV set and then they're coming in because the thing has clotted. So no surprise there.
No surprise there. Thank you very much. I just want to make sure I don't ignore any questions that we have. Does anybody still have a question that I handed out that we did not answer on the panel here? And with this, I would like to, first of all, thank all of our presenters, not just today, but throughout the entire conference, for putting in so much time and effort and expertise into preparing these wonderful, many wonderful presentations.